I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Third Squad is a podcast about war. All episodes contain strong language and graphic descriptions of violence that may not be suitable for all listeners.
So I went down there to bury him fresh out of high school. He was a kid. And his dad was about 38, maybe 40. He came up to me and said, "Hey, I tried to join as soon as I heard it happen. They won't let me go over there. They won't let me join. I'm too old." And he goes like, "Hey, can you promise if you can get over there, like, can you do something about it?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, that's all I want to do." So then that, like, became my mission. It was like, no matter what, I was getting to Afghanistan.
I'm Elliot Woods. This is Third Squad. Episode 9, Chasing the War. There's no barber pole outside the straight-ahead barber shop in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. But inside, it's a throwback to the places where I got my hair cut as a kid a few hours from here.
When we were young, there were old-school barber shops.
There were.
But, yeah. Like, in that mid-90s period, I think they, like, all faded and disappeared and nobody replaced them. And
with a long wooden bench where customers wait their turn and a jar of combs bathing in ice-blue Barbicide, straight-ahead is a convincing replacement.
This looks like an antique barber chair.
Yeah, they're both about 100 years old. Oh, I finished them myself. It's the centerpiece of the barber shop, so, like, you have to have an old chair. Like.
The owner's name is Jarek Fry. The first time I met him, he was wearing body armor and a helmet and getting ready to step out on patrol in Sangin. Fry was Third Squad's squad leader, and in the past decade, he's gone from carrying an M4 to wielding clippers in his very own barber shop. Yeah. His body armor and helmet are actually on display next to a shelf of straight-ahead t-shirts. As it happens, I'm in need of a trim.
So when you look at these scant resources of hair that I have on top of my head, what are you thinking? What is your creative vision for...
I think you go, like, pretty tight at the bottom, like, for a wand, maybe even, yeah. Like, tapered out almost.
That sounds good.
Fry has the vintage barber look down. He's got a leather apron and his own hair styled in a classic part with a wave. But he still looks like a Marine, square-jawed and clean-shaven, and a little intimidating, which he says actually helps put his regular clientele at ease. Like,
when I opened my shop, I really wanted to draw the correct customers. You know, I wanted the police, I wanted the military, I wanted the good blue-collar guys, you know, like, I wanted the good community in here. It's not all about making money, it's about the people you affect and the people you surround yourself with.
Greensburg is a Rust Belt city on the east side of Pittsburgh with a lot of empty storefronts and a few stately old buildings that call back to better times. Fry grew up in a smaller town called Irwin, about 10 miles closer to Pittsburgh. He moved back to the area in 2014 when he got out of the Corps, and he's glad to be home.
Pennsylvania's great. The people here are great. My family's from here. I wanted my boys to be raised here.
Fry tells me this area was pretty depressed when he was a kid. But he says Greensburg's been making a gradual comeback. He's proud that his barbershop is one less empty storefront, and he loves his work.
Your barber is not just somebody that cuts your hair. He becomes like a part of like your family, your friends. You're probably going to cut your hair right before you get married. And then on the flip side of it, you know, if a loved one dies, you're probably going to be in here. You know, you're going to court, you're going to be in here. So I'm with you on like the best and worst days of your life. That's what I like about barbering.
Right.
And like, you can't walk into a barber shop and get a good haircut and walk out and not feel better.
That's true. You can definitely walk out of a barber shop with a bad haircut and not feel better, though.
Oh, I just feel defeated. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that drove me to be a barber, is that when I was in the Marine Corps, you know, I'm getting a haircut every single week for 9 years. And there were so many disappointing haircuts. And like, I just never understood it. Like, how is this your job and you're so bad at it? Like, and I was like, I know I can do better than this. Like, I can provide a better service than this.
Yeah.
After a year of COVID buzz cuts at home, Fry's managed to make me look like a respectable citizen again.
That looks great. I feel like a new man.
Fry was 24 years old when we first met in Sangin, one of the oldest guys in the squad. He was reserved around me, but I picked up on his determination to do better, to constantly learn and improve for the benefit of the younger Marines. And as far as he was concerned, their lives were in his hands. Here we are back at Patrol Base Fires.
What's it like to be a squad leader and have responsibility for these guys that are under you on every patrol?
The ability of a squad leader carries a lot of weight. Not only are you in charge of thousands and thousands of dollars of equipment and ammunition, but you're in charge of 10 other Marines' lives. Depending on how hard you are on them and how strict you make them follow and abide by rules and tactics, even when you get tired and lazy and the patrols keep dragging on, you have to keep their head in the game. And if you don't, if one of them lose their lives, it falls on your shoulders.
Fry didn't start the deployment with 3rd Squad. He came as a combat replacement after their original squad leader, Sergeant Andrew Metelsky, got blown up on June 12, 2011. The platoon lost almost all of its senior leaders to the mass casualties in June. So when Fry arrived in July, the younger Marines were still reeling. Boosting their morale and keeping their heads in the game was a matter of life and death.
If one person in the squad's weak, the squad will fail. So everybody has to pull their own weight. Everybody has to know their job, the job below them, and the job above them. It's more like a family that everybody works together real well. Everybody gets along real well. And if you don't, you fail. And failure is not an option out here because people won't go home then.
It was the end of July 2011 when we were talking. 3rd Squad had a little more than 2 months to go before the end of the deployment.
So what do you hope would be the end state for your squad's accomplishments in October? What do you hope that you guys can accomplish by then if you keep up momentum?
The only thing I really care about is getting these guys home and getting home with all their limbs. Anything other than that's just a plus.
All right, we have phones off.
Yeah, I put my phone on.
In the relative quiet of the vacant tattoo shop he shares the building with, Fry tells me about his life before the Marine Corps, growing up in a working-class PA family. His mom worked in the food industry, and his dad worked and still works at a company that manufactures granite countertops.
I call it the Pennsylvania grind. Here in Western Pennsylvania, like these blue-collar guys, they just get in this grind, and it's like good enough. They're never really happy, but like they're doing enough. They're paying their bills, and they just grind away for these employers that just take advantage of them.
But Fry wasn't thinking about any of that as a kid.
I grew up, and my family always knew I was going to go to the military of some sort. It's like my parents joke about that all the time, that like I'd be building bombs and weapons in the basement. And like I always had like G.I. Joes and would set them up in these big elaborate battles and always watched war movies and like my whole life. But like I didn't know that I was going to the military. They did, though.
Fry's destiny didn't become clear to him until his senior year of high school.
I was sitting on my back porch of my house, was thinking about what I was going to do with my life, and I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to get in that blue-collar grind and just work till I was dead. And I like had an epiphany. I just said, well, I'm going to go join the Marine Corps.
He was 17 years old.
My mind was made. I just wanted to go shoot weapons. I didn't know what that meant, but that's all I said.
After high school, Fry went to Parris Island, South Carolina for boot camp. It was June 2005, and even though President George Bush had declared mission accomplished in Iraq 2 years earlier,
in the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
An outbreak of vicious sectarian fighting was derailing plans for an easy exit.
The al-Mahdi army, loyal to the Shiite cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr, was responsible for much of the violence outside Fallujah and Ramadi.
The whole time through boot camp, all they kept telling us, the guys that signed up for infantry, they kept pulling us aside and they were like, hey, you're going to war. Like, there's no question, within a year you will be in Iraq. Which, like, is what I wanted. You know, that's what I was looking for.
When Fry finished recruit training and got to his unit at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, he was surrounded by Marines who were fresh home from the 2004 Battle of Fallujah.
U.S. and Iraqi forces launched a major offensive in Fallujah today.
Which was already notorious in the Corps for some of the worst urban warfare since the Battle of Way City in the Vietnam War.
Some 5,000 U.S. Marines and soldiers staged the ground assault.
And even though Fry got hazed by Fallujah vets who were obviously struggling with what they'd experienced, he still looked up to him. He still wanted a piece of the action. And he prepared for it with laser focus.
I really cared about my job, and I studied it. You know, I would study machine guns and tactics and everything constantly. I just tried to make myself the best I could possibly be to help the Marines around me.
Fry was what's known in the military as a hard charger. Nothing in his life came anywhere close to his devotion to the Corps. Not even his wife, Kristen, who he married when he was only 18. Fry was a Marine infantryman, and he had a single obsession.
I was looking for war. I was looking for the fight. I wanted the kinetic fight. Not knowing exactly what that meant, but I wanted it.
But Fry kept missing the war. In 2006, he participated in the evacuation of nearly 15,000 Americans from Lebanon during the war between Israel and Hezbollah. From a U.S. Navy ship off the coast, he heard the gunfire on shore and watched Israeli jets zip across the sky and entire buildings turn into mushroom clouds. But there was no combat role for the Marines. And the experience left Fry jonesing even more for the real war, the one just across the Syrian desert in Iraq, where other Camp Lejeune Marines were taking part in a bloody campaign to retake a town called Ramadi from Al-Qaeda-linked insurgents.
This battered city has become the operational center of Al-Qaeda and the symbolic heart of the Iraqi insurgency.
Fry did end up getting deployed to Ramadi a year later. But by the time he got there, the firestorm had already passed.
There was a few little firefights, little pop shots, some IEDs found. But for the most part, it was very calm. I lifted a lot of weights and ate a lot of food and patrolled a lot and stood a lot of posts, but we weren't out there getting in firefights, which is what I was looking for, being young and dumb.
Fry signed up to fight the dragon. He wasn't interested in the hearts and minds counterinsurgency stuff. So when the Ramadi hitch was over, he volunteered for another Iraq deployment, hoping this time he'd get his chance. But when he got to his new base outside Fallujah in 2009, the dragon was sound asleep.
We were doing nothing but humanitarian missions and some policing, but mainly we had turned over the forces to Iraqi forces. We were there just to support them at that point, which was basically a huge letdown for all of us. You know, we went over there and it was kind of a waste of time. You know, the thing that I'd been chasing and heard about and read stories and trained for, I wasn't able to do.
Over the course of 5 years in the Marines, Fry had spent a combined 14 months in a war zone where death lurked everywhere. But he never got deep in the shit, and he felt cheated, like a professional athlete stuck on the sidelines. Fry was at the top of his game, hitting every benchmark of success in the Marines. He'd made sergeant in less than 4 years, a rare feat in the Corps.
A sergeant in the Marine Corps is like a god. Like, those are the guys you look up to. Like, the new guys coming in, you don't even talk to a sergeant. You don't even look at them wrong.
Sergeants serve as squad leaders in the Marine Corps, and Fry wanted to lead a squad in the thick of combat in the worst way. But it didn't look like he'd get another chance in Iraq, where the American withdrawal was already underway. Obama's Afghanistan surge, on the other hand, was just ramping up. And when Fry found out that the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines was slotted for a deployment to Sangin, he saw one more chance. He requested and received a transfer from Camp Lejeune out to Camp Pendleton. And almost as soon as he got there, he began tryouts for 3-5's elite sniper platoon.
They told us to get our packs, and then we had to run the hoy to the top of the hill. I had about 90 pounds on my back, and I stepped in a wadi, like a runoff, and I hyperextended my right knee and blew out my ACL, LCL, and both meniscus with one fatal swoop.
The injury was severe enough that Fry had to be pulled from the line. So when 3-5 shipped out for Sangin in the autumn of 2010, Fry wasn't with them.
And initially, it was all anger, and it was like, I was just missing it. Like, I missed something. Like I said, I was chasing it and chasing it and chasing it. It was there. I was there. And then I got hurt and couldn't do what I wanted to do, you know, what, like, I thought I wanted to do in my heart.
While he was injured, Fry had helped train young 3-5 Marines. Now they were in harm's way, and the bad news started rolling in almost immediately.
They deploy, and I go in for surgery. I'm laying in a hospital bed, and my buddy Maloney, he came in and he tells me that one of my Marines was the first to die in Afghanistan. Lance Corporal Sparks was shot and killed. And he was one of my Marines from my machine gun squad that I was in charge of. And that just crushed me because I'm laying there in a bed helpless, and I felt like I should have been there. Like there, in my mind, there was no question if I should have been there.
The fact that he couldn't do anything to help the 3-5 Marines in Sangin tormented Fry. But there was something he could do for the families of the dead back home.
So as soon as I was able to like bear weight at all, I started doing funerals because 3-5 suffered so many casualties. They were really getting beat up.
Fry volunteered for the Honor Guard, the small detachment that escorts Marines' remains back to their families.
I thought that if it's the only thing I can do is take these guys home, take them to their family and put them in the ground and give them the respect that I could, you know, that was my responsibility, that I had to do that.
Part of his duty was pulling guard beside the caskets during wakes and funerals.
So the entire time that the service was open and the people were allowed in, we had a Marine standing at the head of the casket, and we were in full dress blues the whole time. And they stood there completely motionless. It'd be like an hour. We'd replace him, and we'd do a replacement ceremony. So you walk up and you slow salute, and then you take his place, you take charge of the post. As you're there, you can't talk, you can't do anything. People are crying on you, they're thanking you, they're asking you questions, and you can't really talk. You're just there as a statue.
Whenever they weren't on casket guard, Fry and the other Marines did their best to comfort the families.
So we were going and meeting their families and meeting their kids and meeting their wives and their fathers, and they're asking you these questions, and you don't necessarily know the Marines that you're burying, but you know who they are. You know, all Marines, and especially anybody that gave their life for their country willingly, mainly for their brothers, they deserve that respect. And it was very, very difficult because all I wanted to do in my power was be over there.
Fry did 5 funerals in a matter of a few months. It wasn't combat, but being so close to so much anguish was eviscerating.
It was the hardest time of my life as far as mentally goes. I really got into drinking heavily. I mean, I was probably almost drinking a fifth a night just to sleep.
The funeral that really gutted him was for a 3-5 Marine from Texas who was killed by a sniper in Sangin on December 6th, 2010. His name was Private First Class Colton Rusk.
So I went down there to bury him fresh out of high school. He was a kid. And his dad was about 38, maybe 40. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, I tried to join as soon as I heard it happen. They won't let me go over there. They won't let me join. I'm too old." And he goes like, "Hey, can you promise if you can get over there, like, can you do something about it?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, that's all I want to do." So then that like became my mission, is like, no matter what, I was getting to Afghanistan.
We'll be back after the break.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So when PFC Rusk's dad said, "Can you go over and do something about this?" Were you thinking, "I'm going to go over there and get revenge?" Or were you more thinking, "I'm going to go over there so that the next PFC Rusk comes home?"
I mean, initially, like, all that reaction, it all starts out as anger. You know, like, when you see people die that, you know, some asshole shot them for whatever reason or blew them up, it's anger at first. But then when it settles and, like, your right mind comes around, it's that. You want to bring people home.
Fry was desperate to get deployed to Sangin as a combat replacement, one of the Marines who would be sent over to fill in for 3-5's wounded and dead. There was a problem, though. Because of his knee surgery, he'd actually been put into the pipeline for medical separation. He was a broken weapon, and the Corps didn't want him anymore. But Marines are trained to adapt and overcome, and that's exactly what Fry did.
It was before the Marine Corps switched to digital, and when you switch units, you get your medical record, and you have to take it to the next medical facility. So when I took my paperwork to the next medical facility for the next unit, I pulled all of my surgery paperwork out of it and then turned it back in. So as far as anybody was concerned, I was full duty. That never happened.
Three-Five came home while Fry was healing up and getting back in shape. Over their 7-month tour in Sangin, the battalion had lost 25 Marines. 184 more were wounded, with 34 of them losing at least one limb. Now it was 1-5's turn in the meat grinder. Stuck back at Camp Pendleton in the late spring of 2011, Fry read 1-5's classified combat action reports from Sangin with a mix of horror and frustration. Like the ones about a 6-day stretch of catastrophic IED strikes in June 2011 that robbed the patrol base Fires Marines of their squad leaders and their platoon sergeant, leaving them with almost no experienced leadership at the squad level.
As soon as I saw that, I knew I had to go. There wasn't an option. I didn't care if I had to sneak on a plane to go over there, buy my own ticket. I was going there to help them.
Fry made a bold move. He took his request directly to the most senior enlisted man out of the nearly 5,000-strong 5th Marine Regiment, a pretty much unheard-of leap in the chain of command. But Fry had met the sergeant major at Rusk's funeral, and he was pretty sure he made a good impression.
He was like, "Sergeant Fry, you're a good Marine. You know, we want more of you around. If you ever need anything from me, don't hesitate to ask." And I noted that and kept that in my pocket. And when this came up, I said, "That's the only guy I can go to. If somebody can get you there, like, he can just call the order right there and you're going to go." So I went to the regimental office and walked upstairs to his office, and he technically had an open door policy, which, like, they all technically do, but you don't ever go in a sergeant major's office.
Sergeant majors are scary. This one, Regimental Sergeant Major Ernest Ho'opi'i, was 6'3" and looked like he could rip a phone book in half.
And I go in and he remembered me and I told him that. I said, "Hey, Sergeant Major, I know this is happening to this company, to this platoon. Yeah, you need to send me over there." And he said, "Sergeant Fry, are you sure?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he said, "Are you ready? Is that all your orders, like everything ready for you to go? Can you leave?" And I said, "Yes." And 5 days later, I was on a plane to Afghanistan, to the worst place in the world.
On one of his stopovers en route to Sangin, Fry picked up a carton of Marlboro Reds and a couple of logs of Copenhagen. He didn't use tobacco himself, but he figured it would soften his landing with the lost boys of patrol base fires.
It's like gold, so I brought it for the Marines because like I knew that they would appreciate that. It's like a welcoming peace treaty gift.
After a few days base hopping from California to Sangin, Fry hitched a ride on a gun truck out to PB Fires in early July 2011. He'd barely stepped inside the wire when the platoon commander told him to gear up.
Lieutenant Poulton goes, "Hey, you're going to go out with that squad. Do you need any ammo or anything?" And I was like, "Yes." So he loaded me up with ammo. I got a full combat load, and they briefed me very quickly, and I stepped right off on patrol immediately. I mean, under a week, I was patrolling in Sangin from being in America, which is insane.
The squad Fry stepped out with was 3rd Squad. He was their new leader, but on that first patrol, he was just along for the ride. Michael Miner had been filling in as squad leader since Metelsky got hit on June 12th, and Miner was still in charge for one last patrol.
Corporal Miner's leading it, and I remember stepping out of the wire, and I had read all the after actions, and I had known what they'd gone through, and we're walking in a single file line with a metal detector in the front, which is nothing that I've experienced before. And that moment, I accepted that I wasn't going to make it out of there, except on a helicopter or in a body bag. I had to put my thoughts and my safety aside right then because I knew that was the only option to be successful.
Fry didn't just have to accept the danger in order to do his job. He had to bury his own fear for the sake of 10 Marines and a Navy corpsman he'd just met, whose lives were now entrusted to him.
You can't be afraid as a leader. You can't show fear. You have to be that strong, steady rock. And I wanted to be that for those guys. So the acceptance of the fact that I'm going to lose a leg or my life or both was almost relieving. Not a fear anymore. It's almost a power.
Back at Fires after that first patrol, Fry took stock of the platoon he'd read about in those combat action reports back at Camp Pendleton.
All the Marines were just beaten down. I mean, they've just been beat up at that point. You could just tell morale was low. I mean, they didn't have their squad leaders. You know, their squad leaders were hit and gone, and that's their sergeant, you know. That's the person they relied upon, and he's gone now.
So what were the first days like with them? Did you feel like they were looking at you like, what's this guy going to be like? Who is this guy?
It's like a new person joining a family. You know, like if you entered somebody else's family and you're like, "Hey, I'm here." For me, it was very heavy. Like, I didn't take it as a light situation. This was a heavy thing, entering it correctly. Those guys in that specific situation, I couldn't really understand where they were at. I didn't know how they felt.
By the time Fry got there in July 2011, half the guys in 3rd Squad had already suffered at least one TBI. Shearer and Lopez still had abrasions on their faces from blasts. Rich Volsky was just back from 2 weeks in the hospital after being nearly killed by shrapnel. They'd all heard McDaniel screaming, and they'd all combed through the grass trying to recover O'Brien. The guys might not have said it out loud, but they were scared. They were also burning for revenge, an emotional state that can lead to reckless decisions with fatal consequences. Fry could have come in like a hammer, playing the hard ass. But he knew what the squad really needed was a cool head.
I showed them that I was there to just help them, and that the only thing that mattered to me was their safety.
He also knew that he would probably never fully belong.
they did the workup together. You know, they suffered losses together. And before I got there, you know, the struggle brings people closer. They accepted me as much as I think you could possibly do that in that situation.
After 6 years in the Corps, Fry was finally where he wanted to be. Exactly where he was needed most.
Every time I planned something, I talked to him. If they told me on a patrol that they didn't like something, you know, if a guy got a bad feeling, you know, that intuition, I followed it. I trusted him fully. I didn't demand respect of them, but I earned it, and then they gave it to me.
He was back doing counterinsurgency again, but there was lots of lead whizzing around. The Taliban would often shoot at the Marines to try to herd them towards IEDs. The typical response to contact was to maneuver, to close with and destroy the enemy. But maneuvering could mean funneling the squad right into an IED trap. So whenever 3rd Squad got shot at, Fry directed him to drop in place and unload everything they had in the direction the fire was coming from.
We received fire a few times and just overwhelmed them with firepower because that's my concept of warfare. So our squad had stopped being attacked for the most part, I believe because of our posture.
On a day-to-day basis, the squad's mission was mind-numbingly repetitive. Walk around advertising their presence to the Taliban while trying not to step on IEDs. But there was a larger official objective, even if most of the guys in 3rd Squad had never heard it explained. The backstory goes deep into the Cold War, and it adds a whole nother dimension to the concept of the Forever War. It's important because it offers a specific answer to that big, nasty question. What was it all for? The history is a little too complicated to get into right here, but if you're interested, stick around after the credits for a more detailed explanation. What you need to know now is that at the time of the surge, the U.S. State Department and top military brass believed that delivering more electricity to southern Afghanistan would strike a devastating counterinsurgency blow to the Taliban. The linchpin of this untested idea was the rehabilitation of a hydroelectric power station 20 miles upriver from Sangin at the Kajaki Dam, which was itself a relic of one of the most expensive and tragically misguided nation-building efforts in American history. But there was a huge problem. The supply road to the dam went through some of the most ambush and IED-plagued terrain in the country, including Sangin, which meant that convoys carrying workers and construction materials were under constant threat of attack. Clearing that road and keeping it open would be one of the core missions of the Surge Marines in the Helmand River Valley, even if they were only dimly aware of the endgame, more electricity and more jobs in southern Afghanistan. In the most narrow terms, that's what it was all for. All of this was above Fry's pay grade. He saw the war through a gun sight, and as far as he could tell, the PB Fires Marines seemed to be beating back the Taliban in their sector of the quagmire that summer. There were fewer firefights, and the squad spent more time visiting with locals. But even when it was quiet, Fry says the AO was nowhere near secure.
You had to go out there with the mindset of, I might get in a firefight, or I might sit down and have to drink tea with this person while somebody's watching me and might be setting an IED up on the way home.
They often stopped to talk with a family who lived almost within sight of PB Fires. There were usually a bunch of kids who would run out and ask for candy and snacks from the guys. But when the squad approached on one particular day in late July, the kids were nowhere to be seen.
One of them's hiding behind the corner and he's going, no, 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 no. And he's like waving his hand and we're like, what? You know, what's going on? And he's like, and wouldn't say anything. He was just shaking his head. And he said, like, boom, boom. We were like, oh. Like, we walk down this road every day. They put an IED on it. So we slowed our patrol down, start pushing. We had our engineer, we had Robinson with us at the time. So he slows down. We start sweeping real slow. We have our guard up. You know, we have our weapons up. We're looking all around. I set up little secure postures around us. And he finds 3 IEDs in the middle of the road. the kids saved us. You know, that building that relationship, building that trust with the kids, just little stuff, you know, saved us that day. Somebody would have hit that.
I really hate this part.
Yeah, you might want to get down.
I happened to be out with Third Squad that day.
15 seconds.
So I was there when the explosive ordnance disposal team came out and safely detonated the IEDs.
Oh my God, God damn, I'm glad that didn't go off.
I took a picture of one of the pressure plates that the EOD guys dug up. Two thin strips of what looked like balsa wood taped together with a slim gap between them and a wire sticking out one side. A low-tech weapon used to devastating effect against the most high-tech military in the world. Third Squad had already seen what the Taliban bomb makers could do before Fry arrived, but he would have his chance to witness it too. First with Matthew Forrett, and then with Michael Dutcher.
September 15th, we stepped out. It's a normal patrol, just like every other day that we do. We had a patrol route to go over the river, and we were going to like the other side of the AO. We would get civilians to lead us through areas that we kind of avoided because there were IED strikes there before, or people didn't go there, or abandoned buildings. We would avoid those situations unless we had a civilian to lead us, because all the civilians in the area knew where all the bombs were. Whether they told us or not, they knew where the bombs were. So we went across, and there was a sheep herder. And so we asked the sheep herder to lead us behind this building.
This is the story Manny Mendoza told me in Texas. Michael Dutcher was at the front of the patrol.
So he was walking behind this guy, and usually when they'd walk, we wouldn't really sweep much. We would sweep, but like, they would usually walk fast, so it was kind of quick, hasty sweeping. And then Mendoza's right behind him with his weapon protecting him and marking the ground. So we go behind a building, and they go out of sight because I was about halfway back on the patrol. And then the strike went off. Everybody froze, you know, because everybody just stops when that happens. Because if you start moving, there's always secondary and tertiary IEDs. So they did the correct thing, you know, stop, look around. So we're looking for somebody to start shooting at us now at this point. Bo immediately starts spinning up air because he knows somebody got hit by an IED. I just ran. I didn't care for my life at that time, honestly. I just wanted to make sure that I could get to them, possibly see what happened, start treating the situation, provide safety for the guys that got hit, because I didn't want them to get shot at as they were down or trying to work on them. I was providing cover, holding Dutcher's hand. He was somewhat coherent at the time. I saw that it was a femoral bleed in his pelvis, which is, I mean, anybody in the medical field knows that that's it. Even if he was in a hospital when that happened, I mean, you bleed out in a minute. Mendoza did a great job. He was packing the wound. He was applying pressure, really addressing the casualty. You know, he was doing fantastic. And he wasn't even aware. That was all muscle memory. He was not even there. He was in that blast with Dutcher. He must have been steps behind him. Bo cleared the field behind us. They created an LZ. We got Dutch out to the LZ before they were, you know, 10 minutes away in the air. We got a call over the radio that he had passed.
Take me back to the way that you were feeling at that time, having made it so close to getting the guys out of there. And then you're in that scene where you realize that the worst thing has happened.
You know, at the time, I couldn't get tunnel vision on the fact that Dutcher was hit, because my responsibility is to the other 10 guys in the patrol. It's very easy to get sucked in. I was trying to keep everything under control, you know, in the worst possible situation that you could be in. I was trying to keep everything handled. That's all my focus was. Knew it was going to happen. You know, the possibility of it happening was very, very high. Just didn't know when. and I reacted as I should. You know, I don't think that I could have reacted any differently, any better. Could have definitely went worse, but it luckily didn't.
Tell me about the hours after the IED strike and getting the patrol back to the patrol base and how the rest of that day played out.
You know, it really got heavy then, because now I can grasp the situation. I'm in my safety of my patrol base. I can now think about what was just going on. It got very heavy. It was very hard. And I allowed myself to mourn momentarily. But then had to then immediately forget about it, push it aside, and get detail-oriented again, because we still have 30 more days or whatever it was to go. And I still have all these other Marines that I'm accountable for. So we had to like move on with the mission, because you don't have an option.
At that funeral in Texas, when Fry told Colton Rusk's dad that he would get to Afghanistan come hell or high water, and when he went to the sergeant major to plead for a spot as a combat replacement, he had one overriding objective.
I was a senior sergeant. I had multiple deployments under my belt. I was very experienced. So I felt this mass responsibility to help take these junior Marines and bring them home.
That mission ultimately proved impossible, just as it had for Sergeant Andrew Metelsky, the squad leader Fry replaced, and for just about everyone with a leadership position in the battalion. By the time 1-5 came home in October 2011, 17 of their Marines had been killed and 191 had been wounded. Watching one of his own Marines bleed out and being constantly forced to imagine his own death transformed Fry.
So you were talking about how accepting that you might die or get severely wounded changed you permanently, that you can't undo that.
Yeah.
What do you think about that now, all these years later, looking back on that?
I mean, it altered my entire life. That experience, that acceptance, that understanding and being okay, looking back on that now spiritually, that is like accepting God without saying it. It really steers my life and guides my life to push myself, constantly push myself, because I'm experiencing this life that I didn't think that I should. I didn't think that I was going to be here. So in things that I do, I push myself harder. I try harder. I do whatever I can, because every day is a gift as far as I'm concerned. So I have to use that. You know, I can't settle to be mediocre.
We'll be back after the break.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After Sangin, Fry says he didn't feel like he needed to chase the war anymore.
I did satisfy that hunger going to Sangin, that missing piece that I had. I did quench that. It was a lot more than I thought it was going to be when I got there. I'll say that. You have an idea of what you think that you're getting into, and then there's that reality of what you actually get into. And the reality was much greater than what you thought it was.
Facing that reality with Dutcher's death was enough for Fry. He didn't want to do it again. His wife was also expecting their first child, a boy who they would name Jack. The thought of potentially being killed on another deployment and leaving his baby fatherless was unbearable. So when Fry saw an opportunity to get out of the deployment rotation by serving as an instructor at the infantry officer course in Quantico, Virginia, he took it. 2 years later, he decided to get out of the Corps altogether. It wasn't easy for Fry to become just another civilian. In fact, the comedown was more like a crash.
I was something in the Marine Corps. I was like the Marine. I was a badass. I was perfect at my job. I never met anybody better at my job than me. Never. And to accept that, like, that was a different life, you know, that was something that I did. I won't ever do that again. Like, I was the coolest that I'll ever be when I was like 26.
Fry was accustomed to getting respect and admiration from other Marines, including the officers he trained at Quantico. But that changed the moment he decided to get out. It was like he was a cult member being shunned for his decision to return to society.
As soon as they found out that, like, I was getting out, I signed the papers, I was gone, it didn't matter anymore.
No matter how good you were before.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you did before, what you did up to that point. Now that you're leaving, they don't care.
Fry found out quickly that nobody on the outside gave a shit about his years as a badass Marine either.
You know, you apply for a job and they want you to have a degree. But while these kids were going to college and getting degrees in basket weaving, I was in the military. I did my 9 years of service. You know, I was in charge of more men, more responsibility, doing everything from hygiene to maintenance to cleaning to, it doesn't matter, logistics. It's all encompassing. You know, we control every part of somebody's life. Like, I did this stuff and none of that mattered. I basically gave up 9 years to start over.
Back home in Pennsylvania, the hard-charging, purpose-driven Marine would spend his first 2 years as a civilian neck-deep in the most unskilled labor, digging ditches for gas and plumbing lines. It was not a good fit. Down in those ditches, the weight of Sangin started to bear down on Fry. His marriage broke up and a brief relationship led unexpectedly to a second son. Whenever he didn't have his boys, he would resist going home after work to an empty house where he'd be alone with his thoughts. He took to closing down the bars, drowning his grief and his grievances in alcohol and burning a hole in his pocket.
Until just, I had an epiphany one day, like, covered in shit, standing on a hillside in February in Pennsylvania, that this is not what I was made to do. There was a barbershop that was looking to expand, so I started pursuing it.
The other barbers offered Fry a new kind of brotherhood and a renewed sense of purpose. A year later, he decided to go out on his own and open Straight Ahead, where he offers something more than a haircut to those blue-collar guys who wind up in his chair.
You know, people perceive me as something because I'm tattooed and I'm larger and I was in the Marine Corps. So then when I open up and show them that, like, I'll talk about emotions, I'll talk about, like, the stuff that you don't really want to talk about, it sets people back. But I also get a lot of people that will open up to me because of that.
Being there on his customers' best and worst days and the days in between gives Fry a sense of community that's infinitely better than the bar rooms he used to haunt. And home isn't a place Fry avoids anymore. In 2017, he met a woman named Emily who was also figuring out life as a single parent. Now they're married and raising their boys together. It was Emily who encouraged Fry's newfound faith. Meanwhile, his barber friends turned him on to a different strain of religion.
If you're here, he starts passing me, especially in a gi.
Jiu-jitsu.
I started doing it.
Just do it, you know?
A martial art that channels the discipline and grit he developed as a Marine. Like, he teaches classes at a local gym a few times a week, and he trains with monastic devotion for his own semi-pro fights. He's even launched a nonprofit called the Veteran Bushido Brotherhood that provides free martial arts training to veterans.
The physical pain and the physical struggle get you out of your own head for a moment, and everything becomes way clearer, and you just feel better. You know, you just feel way better.
In a play on fuck cancer, the Bushido Brotherhood rash guards say fuck PTSD. It's a tough approach from a tough guy who's learned to be vulnerable. A fighter who broke the hold of his pain by reaching for connection.
Has the story gotten easier to tell the more you tell it?
Yes, the pain subsides a bit and more of an acceptance of it. But the main thing that makes it easier is that I use it for growth. And because I use it for growth, I don't view it as a negative thing anymore. You know, where it was, you know, it was something that you push deep down in your stomach and hide and don't talk about because men don't talk about stuff like that. And it becomes easier when you accept it and bear it and get better because of it.
There's a name for the positive outlook Fry's describing: post-traumatic growth, or PTG. It's an emerging field of study that's like a halogen lamp at the end of a dark tunnel. An antidote to what Fry sees as the curse of PTSD.
If we accept this thing, this blanket statement, like, oh, he has PTSD, take pills. And now it's a crutch. If it becomes a permanent crutch, you know, this is something that you will just, it's that negative lifestyle for forever. Like, you're just stuck on it. You're stuck in that negative cycle. You just got to say no to it.
There's a line from Ernest Hemingway, who was injured as an ambulance driver in World War I, that captures the idea of PTG pretty well. The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places. It's kind of like what I was saying to Matthew Forrett in Texas, when I talked about the tree that gets struck by lightning and grows around the damage. Researchers have identified a few reliable pathways to post-traumatic growth. Disclosure. Telling the story and being real about the trauma and its effects. Narrative development, accepting the past and imagining how the bad days can be the foundation of a brighter future. And service, building community by helping others overcome their challenges. Fry figured out most of this stuff by trial and error, and now he's passing it on.
If I can teach people and help one person, you know, like one person, understand and feel better about themselves and be more productive and like have better mindset because of my experiences that I can share, like, absolutely, like, I'll do that all day long. I'll tell my story 8 billion times and show my weakness to people, because it's not weakness, you know, it's the strength of, you know, being able to use it as a weapon.
There was a long time when Fry wanted nothing more than to be a weapon. But by the time he got to Sangin, he was an old man for a grunt. His hunger for action had given way to a simpler desire to help. He was only squad leader for about 3 months, but his feelings of responsibility didn't just go away in the years after they said goodbye.
I knew that, like, they weren't going to be well, you know. I would try to reach out to some of them on Facebook if I could catch them, and I was working a lot, and I didn't really, whatever excuse is out there, we lost connection. But it wasn't a week that went by that I didn't think about how they were doing, if they were all right, if they were being successful, if they were locked in a bedroom, you know, up all night.
Several of the third squad vets were struggling, staying up all night, fighting their demons with booze and drugs. One of them, whose post-military life happened to be the picture of success, was teetering on the edge of the abyss.
It was like 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and my phone rings. Nobody ever calls my phone. So something triggered in me. You know, I had to answer the phone. Any other time, I would have hit cancel. And I pick up the phone, and I could just hear the pain. You know, as soon as I answer, I knew who it was immediately.
It was Manny Mendoza.
Yeah, man, he answered the phone. It was like 4 a.m. He was in Pittsburgh.
He was like hysterical. I could just tell the pain in his voice. And he like was by himself at college in his dorm room. He drank a little bit, and then he went and watched Lone Survivor by himself. And it just triggered all of it.
So many different ways that could have gone, but it went the wrong way.
To me, it sounded like he maybe never even thought about it before, the whole situation with Dutcher, because he was blown up, and I mean, Mendoza was right behind him, and Mendoza like was kind of knocked dumb for weeks. Like, we kept him on base, we didn't let him patrol anymore, but like, I was actually in fear that he wasn't going to return to normal, because like, he would just like sit on his rack and like stare. You would talk to him and he was not there. It took weeks for him to come back. So when I'm hearing this, it was like a first outpouring of like a realization of what happened. And he didn't remember completely. And he thought it was his fault.
It was all my fault. It was me. I did it.
Like, in his voice, there was no question when he called me that he thought he was responsible for Dutcher's death. Basically, the only thing that I could do and knew what to do is talk to him and let him talk. And then I told him if anybody's responsibility was mine, that Dutcher died.
And he put the blame on himself.
I was the squad leader. I was in charge. These were my Marines. I dictated the route. So these were my choices that led us to go on this route that Dutcher got hit.
And he said, no, I was the squad leader. I was the sergeant. I was in charge of that patrol.
I couldn't let him try to bear that. I knew that I could. I was in the right mind to bear that weight. And he wasn't.
I guess that got to me. Yeah, it got to me and made me, I guess, I realized that there are people who care.
I was like, get that out of your fucking head. You're not in charge. This is my patrol. This is my decision. It's not yours. You were following my direction. And it kind of like brought him back down. And I could tell his temperament changed. Everything kind of changed and calmed down.
Because I was feeling the burden. And here is Jarek putting the burden on himself. And it wasn't even him. But here he is trying to take that responsibility. Because he cares.
I made sure that he was, like, good. When I left the phone, I felt confident that he was in a much better place.
He was listening. He actually listened.
Did he tell you that he had a gun?
No.
Did you know that?
No.
So yeah, the story that we heard from Manny is pretty much identical to what you just told us, except for the fact that he had a gun and was planning on taking his life that night. And the way he tells the story, you saved his life.
That's like the situations like that is like proof that God is like there. You know, like there's no other way that like I would have answered that phone. Or that I would have the words, you know, to comfort him in that situation. And that I was put there, you know, to be his squad leader. And then to follow through with that, you know, in the future. I mean, that's, you know, absolute confirmation to me. You hear people like, I wish I would have just answered the phone. I wish I would have talked to him. I'm just so thankful that I answered the phone.
Fry didn't have to go to Sangin. He could have filed his medical paperwork and put the Marine Corps behind him, gone home to Pennsylvania and got on with his life. But in a gesture that bore little resemblance to the blind leap of a 17-year-old recruit, Fry made a choice to risk death to help a few scared kids he'd never met.
We don't deploy for the country, you know, you're not thinking of that. You're not deploying for the greater cause or something. You are deploying to support your brothers and bring your brothers back. You know, that is what you're trying to do. You're trying to make sure that as many people that are your brothers, your guys, your Marines, you bring them home.
I'm pretty cynical about the greater cause that generated so much bloodshed in Helmand. The plan to build peace by bringing a surge of violence, along with wads of cash and a distant promise of electricity. The plan to keep Americans safe by killing the Afghans we didn't like and forcing our protection on the ones we did. But I was a journalist in Sangin. My job was to ask questions, and that's still my job a decade later. Fry was a 24-year-old sergeant, and for him, there was no greater cause than bringing Marines home alive. He'd seen the alternative up close, standing guard next to caskets while families collapsed into bottomless sorrow. He didn't want anyone else to go through that. In the end, he couldn't save Dutcher or spare his family. But he's not a failure. There are 10 young men home alive from Sangin, whose families owe a lot to Fry. And there's one kid from the Rio Grande Valley who owes him everything. Next time on Third Squad, we drive to upstate New York to visit Taylor Moody, Third Squad's hungriest Marine.
I don't think I could have been more than 1% body fat. I could feel myself getting weaker and weaker and weaker, but having to carry more and more and more because more and more people were getting blown up or killed. Coming back from Sangin, one of the first things that I did was order a 24 party pack from Taco Bell. That was a mistake. I was on that pot within about 15 minutes after finishing those tacos, and I was there for a minute. I was there for a while.
Just a reminder, if you want to stick around after the credits, I'll come back to that footnote about America's wild Cold War experiment in Helmand. Third Squad is written and produced by Elliot Woods, Tommy Andres, and Maria Byrne. It's an Heirloom Media production distributed by iHeartMedia. Funding support for Third Squad comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities in collaboration with the Center for War and Society at San Diego State University. If you're interested in supporting our work with a financial contribution, please visit the donate page at thirdsquad.com, where you'll also find photographs from Sangin and from our road trip. Original music for Third Squad by Mondo Boys. Editing and sound design by John Ward. Fact-checking by Ben Kalin. Special thanks to Scott Carrier, Marianne Andre, Ted Genoways, Benjamin Bush, Caitlin Esch, Carrie Gracie, Kevin Connolly, Lena Ferguson, and Daniel Wegeland of Georgetown University. If you got a minute, please leave us a rating in your preferred podcast app. It'll help other people find the show. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Elliot Woods. Now, back to that footnote. America's pre-9/11 experience in Afghanistan is a case study in the law of unintended consequences. During the Cold War, the U.S. spent three decades and more than $600 million in today's dollars in an effort to make the Helmand Desert bloom and usher in a new era of modern agriculture. It was all part of a campaign to diminish Soviet influence in southern Afghanistan. The Afghans who held power in Kabul had a different goal. They wanted to increase the authority of the central government in the rural south, home to nomads and occasionally rebellious Pashtun families who preferred to be left alone. In what would become a monument of failed nation building, American contractors based out of an enclave called Little America built the dam at Kajaki and a vast irrigation network in the Helmand River Valley. They designed and oversaw the construction of canals that Marines would slosh across half a century later, when they flooded into Helmand with the surge in yet another attempt to expand the power of Afghanistan's central government into the Pashtun heartland by force. The Cold War project was known by several names over the years, but the one that stuck was the Helmand Valley Authority, or HVA. The Kajaki power station was the HVA's last big stroke before the Soviet invasion brought it to a halt in 1979. In the decade of war that followed, America switched from funding agriculture to arming the anti-Soviet militias known as Mujahideen. By conservative estimates, at least 500,000 Afghans died in the fighting before the Soviets finally withdrew in 1989. Then, the Mujahideen turned on each other in a vicious struggle for power known as the Afghan Civil War. They laid waste to Kabul and brought an era of warlordism and exploitation to rural areas that only ended when the Taliban seized power in 1996. Afghans measure their forever war in generations, not years. Amid all the chaos, Kajaki fell into ruin, and its electricity output dropped to a trickle. But poppies thrived in Helmand thanks to all that American-built irrigation infrastructure. The province became the opium capital of the world, and eventually a major power center for the Taliban. In the 21st century, it would become the deadliest province for coalition troops in all of Afghanistan. On the eve of the surge in about 2008, a new generation of nation builders fixed their hopes of saving a failing war on reviving the dreams of the HVA, and above all, on fixing the Kajaki power station. The basic idea was that powering more homes and businesses in major southern population centers like Kandahar City would build trust in the Afghan government's capacity to provide essential services, and would interrupt the Taliban's recruiting pipeline by creating more attractive jobs for young men than IED technician and Taliban gunslinger. No one had ever proved that more electricity would lead to less violence, but that didn't stop the war planners from going all in with American blood and treasure. After hundreds of coalition and Afghan casualties and hundreds of millions of dollars, the Kajaki upgrade was finally completed in 2016. But the surge of electricity didn't stop the Taliban. They retook Sangin and most of Helmand from Afghan troops a year later. And they seized Kandahar City in the days leading up to the fall of Kabul in August 2021. Built on the ruins of American ambition, the Taliban's poppy empire is more lucrative now than ever before. According to the UN, Afghanistan produces about twice as much opium today as it did in 2000, the last year before the American invasion. That's enough to supply more than 80% of the world's heroin. And Helmand, where America spent billions and the Marines shed so much blood, produces more opium than the rest of Afghanistan's provinces combined.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Every family has an origin story. One passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.